Welcome to the podcast where we track down Australian war veterans, have a chat with them, and hear their stories. I'm Alex Lloyd, and this is Life on the Line.
They were building positions in there
if
for a fight.
If anything happened to us, by the time anyone got to us,
I think it was chaos.
The weather was so bad, there would be nobody left.
Boots full of blood.
And the next thing I hear was alarms screaming.
Chances of survival were very, very slim.
The soldiers didn't want to go into the ambushes, so they'd send the kids in first. And so he was sent in first into an ambush, and he got shot in the stomach.
It was very hard for me, very hard for my family.
And the plane burst.
Proud of the crew, proud of what I've achieved and what I'm doing.
To volunteer for service was in effect to put your life on the line.
Dr. Rhys Crawley is an historian at the Australian War Memorial. He's writing for the official history of Australian operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and East Timor. I spoke with Rhys about Australia's longest war, the modern conflict in Afghanistan. Dr. Rhys Crawley, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Alex. Looking forward to it.
Rhys, you're an official historian at the Australian War Memorial. Can you explain for me what that role entails?
I can. We are public servants. So I'm part of a team of 13 historians at the Australian War Memorial that is working on the official histories of East Timor, Iraq and Afghanistan. We're appointed by the War Memorial to write a history. So for the most of the team, we came into the War Memorial. We're employed outside by universities or the Defence Force. We come in, we write that history, which is a history of those actions, those operations in those three conflicts from government records. So we get to write what we want. It's our interpretation of those events, but based on full access to government records, so classified and unclassified.
So the official history of Australia is written by a power separate to the government. I think that's probably a good thing for true objectivity's sake.
Yeah, there's a long foundation of that as well, and that goes back to our first official history series, which is Charles Bean. So Charles Bean created the Australian War Memorial, which happens to pay my bills now. But he was the first official historian, set a foundation there that others have followed. So we're now up to our sixth official history series, and there is the chance to be objective because you are separate. So we're public servants for this project, mainly for the administrative ease, but we still get to approach the task with our opinions and not presenting the government's. And that's really quite different to how official history is done elsewhere, particularly in the US and the UK, where a particular service, so Army, might decide to do an official history in those countries. And it's very much the Army's view of what occurred. And so historians will be appointed to that, but Army get to sort of vet it. That's not the case for us. And another difference is in Australia, it's not about writing lessons. So traditionally, an official history overseas has been a military's chance to sort of gather up the lessons that it learned from that conflict and hopefully not have those same mistakes in the next war. Ours isn't a lesson learned document. It's more about documenting what Australians did overseas in their wars and putting it on the public record for the first time in a detailed way.
Speaking of first official historian Charles Bean, you've got a photograph of him here on your desk.
Yeah, I really like that photo. It's one that shows him sitting at his desk with all his papers and files around him. And that's the work of a historian. You sit there by yourself a lot of the time, surrounded by piles of paper with a pretty messy desk, and try and make sense of all of these different bits and pieces of paper. We have some different challenges in this new project. Most of my material is digital, so it won't sit up and stacked around me like Charles Bean's papers. But he had a mammoth task, and I think we do too. A very different kind of task, but his approach really sort of factors in how we approach our project as well. So nearly 100 years of writing official history, and you can still see Bean's approach throughout.
You mentioned as well you get to write your opinions on the war from a historiographical perspective. Then who has oversight on seeing those opinions are as objective as they can be? Who's the authority you report to?
Well, no real official authority that we report to. In terms of a historical sense, to make sure the historians are not making large errors, we submit it to a peer review process. So that's within our team of as I said before, 13 historians. So they rip it apart and tell us where we need to you know, might need a bit more information on this, or that's too much on one particular topic. And I think for the majority of us, the authors, we will submit and circulate our chapters where we can, because they'll be classified, to people who are security cleared and who have had experience in those various tours or rotations and served, might have been as a commander or might have been as a private, circulate it and get their opinions on what we've written, and then factor that correspondence back into what we write. Now, we can ignore it because it might be wrong, but we can do the good thing and accept it and then challenge ourselves and try and get as close to a version of the truth that we can, which is quite difficult.
And that's under the oversight of Craig Stockings.
Yeah, so Craig Stockings is the sixth official historian, so he's my boss, and he's the current day Charles Bean. And so he sets the tone of the series. So he right at the beginning, before we put pen to paper or started typing things in, is actually the case, he told us where he thought the project should sit and the sorts of things it should focus on. We voiced our opinions on that, but we'll pretty much all in agreeance there. And then he deals mostly with sort of project administration and deals with the other government departments, because we need to get other government department files. The Australian War Memorial doesn't own many of these things. So the Department of Defence or Department of Foreign Affairs, we get their files, we write the history from those files, and then those files go back to their home departments. And at the end of the day, as I said, this is written at the moment as a classified history, because it's used classified records, but it will be turned into an unclassified history, and that has to go through its own process with each of the government departments from whom we receive records. They'll go through and look at it, and they can't take things out based on our opinion. So if they don't like what we've said because it's embarrassing, there's no real grounds there to remove things. But if there's national security issues that are still ongoing, they will let us know and we'll make a case. Either we'll say, okay, we want to push back on that, or accept it and then move on. And there's a long tradition of that as well. So we're used to that. And that's just part and parcel of having the privileged access that official historians do to this material long before the rest of the public, and being able to see it in its entirety to make sense of the big picture, to then try and instill it into something, you know, much smaller and package size that fits into a rather large size book.
Thick hardback edition for people to put on their bookshelves. Can you tell me a bit more about your specific specialty that you're working on at the moment?
So there's six volumes in our history, two on East Timor, one on Iraq, and three on Afghanistan. So six authors, six research assistants, and an office manager. That's how the project unfolds. And I'm the author of one of those volumes. And my volume looks at Afghanistan 2005 to 2010. So that's the second of the three Afghanistan volumes. So wedged nicely between our initial commitment post-September 11, where we sent special forces into Afghanistan, 2001-2002, and then another volume takes up from mine, 2010, through to the end of 2014. Now, we still have troops in Afghanistan, we still have troops in Iraq, but the government's directive was that you'll finish at 2014. So anything post that will have to be the subject of another series one day.
So that ends at the end of Operation Slipper.
That's right. We take it to the conclusion of Slipper. And my volume is really, describe it as the Dutch volume. So the Australians operated with the Dutch in Uruzgan province in Afghanistan, and the Dutch left in 2010. So my book finishes basically with the Dutch leaving, and that brings in a whole range of new dynamics, which is the Americans come in and take over responsibility for that area, and the Australians then work with the Americans. So that's a different story. But my volume is a really operational one, in that there's a lot of fighting that's occurring and a lot of reconstruction and a lot of mentoring. It's really the story of 12 special forces rotations across that period, four reconstruction task forces, so go in and help try and rebuild Afghanistan by engineers, so building bridges, schools, mosques, things like that. Then there's a mentoring and reconstruction task force, which still does the building work, but also starts to mentor the Afghan security forces to eventually be able to take over responsibility for security in their own country. And then it transitions again to a mentoring task force, and that's the end of my volume. And that again is, that's mostly focused on mentoring and going out and doing the same jobs as the Afghans and showing them how we would do it. And hopefully we can learn from each other, but particularly hope that they can learn from us, from our very professional Australian Defence Force.
You mentioned before potential ongoing security clearance issues, and I think Afghanistan is the best case study of that. It's the longest war in our history, and we have men and women who were deployed there over a decade ago going back today in uniform, potentially. The politics of the war are quite difficult, contentious, and change each election cycle, or more often than that, most likely. How do all these factors affect the writing of history?
We'd hope to think that they don't affect it directly, in that we are kept separate. We sit in a bunker and no one can come and bother us, which is quite nice. The fact that the story is unfinished is certainly there. So while I said our history finishes in 2014, clearly what has happened since then affects how you write about Afghanistan and how you think about it. And that may change between now and the time that we finish our book as well. So that's a picture that keeps updating every day. Luckily, on the political issues, for Afghanistan, as opposed to Iraq, it wasn't really ever that politically sensitive. So I've spoken to former prime ministers and defense ministers and ministers of foreign affairs, etc. And that's the sort of comment that keeps coming through. It wasn't really that politically contentious. It was supported on both sides of government. So the story really is the sensitive bits are the operational bits and not wanting to give away certain secrets about how our forces go about doing their business. You know, you want to tell that as much as you can, but you need to be conscious that this may still be the way we operate. Our job, though, is not to self-censor there. Our job is to write it and then have the Defence Force tell us where the bits are too sensitive and that they need to remain secret.
And even then, so you might have to obfuscate some operational detail, but you can still recount the history and the humanity of what's gone on there with some good degree of accuracy and honesty.
Yeah, the important part is being able to know the full story as much as sources allow, so that the day that the Defence Force says, okay, this bit is a bit too sensitive, we know what we can change without changing the story. And many of us in the team have experience working on previous official histories. And that's actually quite a straightforward process. It's a process by where the government or the departments go through it line by line, tell us what the bits are that are a problem, and we find a way to get around that, in that we might just need to rephrase something because it removes the sensitivity. Or sometimes we will have to delete it. But you delete it in a way that doesn't change the story. And that's the important part, because you want to tell the story of as many of these men and women as you can. You know, there's thousands who serve in the Middle East in the period covered by my volume. There's 20-odd who are killed, hundreds who are wounded, and you want to be able to give their justice to their story.
What's the tone or the writing style of this official history like? Is it focused on big picture operational, or are you diving in there as well and really featuring quotes from troops on the ground and giving a real first-person perspective, not just the generals and that kind of larger overview?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mixture. Most of the tone is at an operational level, which is quite different from the sort of history that Charles Bean wrote, which was really focused on the tactical details, what's happening on the ground. While Bean did that, it's really interesting because most of the people he interviewed were officers. And I think that's our experience so far. Most of the people we've interviewed are officers, and most of the people who are writing things are officers. So we are writing at that operational level. It's to put context to the operations. So we go up into the politics where we need to. We go into the strategy where we need to, and what other countries are doing where we need to. But the main focus is on Australian operations. That's what the government has asked us to do. And where we need to make sense of those operations, we dip down to what Private Joe Bloggs was experiencing in the field and use quotes from them. So we interview them, which is an important source. But we can't tell every digger's story, and we can't tell the story of every patrol or every operation in a way that Charles Bean did. We don't have the time. The project has a 5-year limit rather than 20-odd years, as some of the previous official histories have taken. And the sources are quite different now in that they don't really allow you to find out who the individuals are. The written records don't name people, which is really quite different to the First World War. And I think my experience of having written about battles in the First World War and now writing about battles or patrols in Afghanistan is it's probably easier for Charles Bean to tell those battles, however larger they were, than the ones I'm writing about, because the sources were there and allowed for that kind of detail. We need to rely on interviews to fill in that detail. And everyone you interview will have a different picture of how that battle unfolded. They'll have their individual perspective, and they might know what the people directly to their left and right did, and they might know why it happened. So that's why it's important to be able to give enough context up and down to make sense of our main theme, which is an operational level of war.
Talking about Bean's official history, do you have any envy of him being there with the men on the front line, or you're quite happy to have been sitting back and a bit more removed from it?
Oh, I'm happy to be removed from it. I think what he did was remarkable. I don't wish to go to war at all, and he was there for the duration of it. It's a different time, and I think he, you know, he had a much harder task in that he had to write a lot of volumes. I've only got to write one. And he largely was responsible for collecting the records in the first place, so making sure that they were written, making sure that they were bundled up and saved. So that's, he had his press job because he was a journalist. He had a job to be an archivist and collect the records, and then he came back and had to write it. I get to sit down and write it. That said, he was able to, he was forming his opinions as the war went on, things he experienced, things he witnessed, which is both a positive and a negative. Okay, you get a good sense of things, but also that can become your only view of something. So I think it's there's quite a lot of benefit in being removed from it in the way that, you know, any historian is removed from their topic. If I was to do ancient history, clearly I need to be removed from that and find out those answers from other sources.
We touched on this a bit earlier, but historians writing about World War I or World War II can see the war in its entirety and decades of aftermath and cause and effect before and after to analyze. We haven't reached the end of Afghanistan yet. The war is not over, and we don't really even know which act of the story we're in. So how does that affect your day-to-day? I know you've got this 2005 to 2010 definitive period, but you know, you can't necessarily see the consequences of everything that's happened then that might happen later. And how does that affect you going forward?
I'm not sure it affects things too much. And I think this is something that even Charles Bean would have faced. They didn't know the effects of the First World War and what it was going to do to the Second World War. And he was writing about these things both as a journalist and as an author, actually closer to the events than we are. His first volume of the official history came out in 1921, so 3 years after the war. He was very close to it. But it is always a challenge because we don't know, as you said, we don't know the end story of this. I'm quite fortunate in that my volume's wedged between two others, and that gets to be someone else's job. But our volumes become a snapshot in time. They're a product of when they're written, and they're also a product of the limitations that are placed on us. Okay, I've got to write about 2005 to 2010 and try as much as you can to sort of be aware of but ignore what comes after that, to try not to use it to judge too much, certainly events and decisions that were taken at the time. And that's a real challenge for a historian. Applying hindsight is something you have to be very cautious of.
Yeah, you're very mindful of withholding hindsight.
Not withholding, but careful in how you use it. You know, if you're going to use hindsight to judge someone and say they made the wrong decision, well, you have to put yourself into that person's shoes and see what the picture looked like to them when they made that decision. And the hindsight might have, you know, it mightn't have been clear for another number of years that that was even another option. There's the stresses of battle. There's the stresses of command. There's stresses of all of this that you have to factor in. So you need to empathize as much as you can with those people doing things and making decisions, but also not hold back if you need to be critical. My policy is if I'm going to be critical of someone, I'll give them a chance to see it beforehand because it's important that they know, that they have a chance to repercharge on that. It doesn't mean I need to accept it, but I think that's about doing the right thing.
Other wars have had soldiers writing diaries, letters to home, and wartime videographers and photographers, but nothing like the utility of a modern-day smartphone and Facebook accounts. Afghanistan might be the most well-documented war by its personnel from that perspective. How does that come into play when writing the official history?
It's a great source. Unfortunately, I think a lot of the really good stuff with the technical age is still lost, in that most of the honest appraisals of a situation you would get in the past would be written in a letter or would be written in a diary. Now I think that stuff's not put on social media so much. It might be blogging, but the blogging's done well after the event. You're not going to sit there and blog in theatre. You won't have good internet connection or the time, and you'll get in trouble generally from the Defence Force if you're doing it. So most of the good stuff is in the Skype calls home or the telephone calls home, and that's not recorded. So we miss that as historians. And that's a really emotional source that we've had in the past that we don't have today. But all of the social media, all of the blogging is actually a great resource, and it helps provide, or it gives people an opportunity to air some grievances, but also to be able to put their war out there for other people. So we can lean on that and use it where we need to. We can point to it so other people can go and have a look at it, whether we write about it or not. But I do think we do miss out on a lot of that emotive stuff that you would have, that you read in those old letters and diaries.
Because then you're getting that after the fact rather than in the moment, and things can change so much with that time to mull over it. I was in the Afghanistan exhibit at the War Memorial yesterday, and you've got lots of great presentations of diggers, nurses, widows speaking to camera about recollections or feelings, and they do so quite emotively, but that's months or years after they were in theatre. It's different, and the raw, this just happened.
Yeah, it's still a useful source despite that. And you just have to be conscious of things change and memory fails and emotions will change a story years down the track. That's not a bad thing. That's just how memory works. And you try and get multiple sources. So if someone says something to me in an interview, I will try and track down and check the accuracy of that. And interviews, I think, are great for something like an exhibition and you need to give a human face to it. But as a historian using it as a source, you have to be quite careful. And I tend to use it to educate myself into what soldiers have experienced and broader issues about the war, and also to look at leads for other research that I might not have previously considered. They might tell me about a patrol that was really significant that I would have just missed because it's one of hundreds. So I can then go and focus and have a look at it and see whether it was significant in the broader scheme of things or significant in an individual sense, in which case every patrol is going to be significant in an individual sense. When we do decide to use it, it provides some flavour that a written record, you know, an official defence record is, they're pretty dry. It'll give some flavour and allow us to tell the story that doesn't just read like bureaucratic text, using all official speak and acronyms and everything else that comes with a defence record.
You mentioned interviews. How do you find talking with today's veterans?
A real privilege. You're doing it as well. We will do hundreds per volume for this project. Now, these people open up. They tell us things that they might not have told their families. It can be quite cathartic for people, can be quite cathartic for the interviewer as well, and really quite emotional. The thing that I've found, I've done a lot of interviews in my time as a historian, but not as many with soldiers as I've done in this project, is just how professional the majority of our people are, how intelligent they are. We're talking to people with multiple master's degrees, with PhDs, with trades, you know, who've had 30 years in the military, who have done and seen wonderful, miraculous things and also terrible things, and have this view of the world that is really impressive and really broad, and they know what's right and wrong. They've got a moral compass that I think people who don't get to speak to the military probably don't appreciate that they have. And it's really a great privilege, and I'm glad we're doing it now. It's, you know, the war for these people, for the most part, wasn't yesterday, but it's close enough that it's still quite raw and they still remember a lot of the details. And if we were to push this history back another 20 years, many of them will have forgotten that. Many will have passed away. So we're trying to grab it now. And that goes back to your question before about writing things so soon after the events. I don't think too soon. You know, there's not a too soon. You grab it, and yes, there's limitations that imposes on you, but if you're having, the journalist has the first draft at history, we're having the second draft in a lot of detail, and then down the track, hopefully other historians come, they look at what we've written, they go back to the sources we've used, they get their own sources because more will come to light, and they update it and take the story forward. That's certainly how it happened for Charles Bean, and I would hope that Afghanistan, East Timor, Iraq are important enough that people do that as well.
Well, on the emotion of talk and the privilege of talking with today's veterans, I have nothing to add. You sum that up exactly how I feel as well. We talked about that Charles Bean photograph at the start, and you wouldn't be able to replicate that personally because you're not dealing with paper, you're dealing with digital records. How does that change things for you besides losing the good photo opportunity?
I think it's harder, and mainly because this is the first time there's been a large project based on digital records. And it's hard for a few reasons. One is the massive records. There's just so much. And there's, you know, you sit down to write anything, you'll do number of drafts, and we'll get a number of drafts for any operational order. It's about finding the one that's not the draft, that's the final one, and hoping that's the final one. And often it might say final, but there's another one. So there's challenges there. There's challenges in that if we look at the photo of Charles Bean, or think of how a historian works when they go to an archive. They get a bunch of paper in a file and they read it and it's in order and it's got the things left and right of it that were important to whoever created that file. In a digital sense, there's not the file. There's lots of individual documents that just sit on a server. And so you don't know what's left and right of that document. So it's quite hard getting the context of any particular document or how much, in my case, Afghanistan might have featured in the daily work of an individual who was writing these things. So there's a number of challenges there. My personal practice is I actually print a lot of this stuff out because I still like to work on paper and I'll write in it on pencil and things. And then I file it and create files like Charles Bean had for the future historian. And part of that is a paranoia that we're always going to be able to access paper unless it burns, whereas I don't know if we'll always be able to access the same kind of digital file. Now, I know our National Archives focus on making sure we can, but that's a historian's paranoia, I think. But it does change the way you work. It means you've got to factor in and out what you will and will not look at, and you have to make calls on that's not important for my project and put it aside. And there's just so much of it. Whereas Charles Bean could sit there and read all of that material. There's a lot of material there. We just can't do that. There's too much. There's the added thing of added challenge of a lot gets lost. In the First World War, you had clerks who filed things and put them away. And unless they were bombed and caught on fire, you generally would keep them. It's pretty easy to delete a digital file. There's issues of storage. There's when a hard drive's full, if it's not backed up properly, does it just get stuck with other hard drives? So there's all challenges here about loss of information as well.
Who can read a floppy disk anymore or anything it files on that from the peacekeeping era, for example? How does an archivist future-proof against that besides printing everything out, or is that the only hope?
No, it's not the only hope. That's my paranoid fear. Archivists are on top of this, and I give them huge credit. They do a great job. They have to be able to open any kind of media. So the floppy disks, I can't open it, but I can go and get someone to open it. Of course, there's challenges. It's not an easy process, but we can still do it. I know our government has practices in place to try and keep up with the times while also being able to capture and open all those previous kinds of documents and floppy disks and whatever. But I, you know, as I said, I stick to paper because I just find it easier.
Reflecting on this period that you're so intensely got your headspace in right now, if you try and take a step back and look at it at the big picture, what's your takeaway from Afghanistan 2005 to 10, Australia's story?
I'd say it's probably still a bit too early for me to answer that question because that picture changes on a daily basis the more I read. I can see why we went back, we as a country went back, and I think our soldiers did a great job in bringing hope to people. But at the end of the day, the success of Afghanistan is not going to come through military operations or a small number of people. It's going to come through political solutions. And that's not something that Australia was really trying to influence. And for the large part, the international community dropped the ball on that. You know, Afghanistan was important enough for us for many countries in the world to lose people in. But all of that means nothing without trying to fix some of the bigger problems there. And they're not problems of the Taliban, they're problems of governance and problems of its region.
Well, Reese, that's a lot to think about, and you're doing very important work. Thank you for having me in your home and for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Do look up the Australian War Memorial online. They have a great social media presence on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you like the episode, please make sure you subscribe to the podcast to get all our interviews with Australian veterans on Tuesdays and bonus episodes on Fridays. Like us on Facebook and Instagram at Life on the Line Podcast and follow us on Twitter at LOTLPod. Life on the Line is brought to you by Thistle Productions. Artwork by Big Cat Design, music by Dan Van Werkhoven. Thanks for listening, and lest we forget.